Hello and welcome to the June 2023 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynemouth area Talking Newspapers monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor, and this month I'm joined by Aileen Clarkson as my co-anchor.
Hello from me. Weren't we spoilt with three long weekends last month and sunny, warm days these last few weeks? If you fancy making the most of the weather, then here are some local events which you might wish to go to.
Saturday 17th June is the Dawlish Armed Forces Celebrations, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Lawn in Dawlish. There is the Armed Forces Parade at 11:30 a.m. from the Manor House to the Lawn. Organised by the Dawlish Town Council, the parade will be led by the South West Comms Band. On the same day, there is also the Repair Cafe from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Strand Centre in Dawlish.
The Shoreden Festival of Music is on from Wednesday the 21st of June to Saturday the 24th of June. The venue is St Peter's Church, Shoreden. From 7:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. each evening, there will be music featuring the Montenegrin Guitar Duo, Trio Bohemo, Chinicky Wind Quintet, and a duo performance by Joanna McGregor on the piano and Adrian Brendel on the cello. Contact www.shoredenfestival.co.uk for tickets.
On Saturday 24th June, there is a fete on the Den in Tynemouth from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
From Wednesday the 28th of June to Sunday the 2nd of July, there is the annual Flower Festival at St Michael's Church, Tynemouth. This will be from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. Look out for my arrangement entitled Volcano and the arrangement entitled Ice by Barbara Rains from the Yellow Team. There will also be gifts and craft stores, refreshments and musical performances.
On Saturday 1st July, there is the Tynemouth Air Show from noon onwards.
On Sunday the 2nd of July, there is the Classic Cars on Parade from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Upper Den Carriageway, Tynemouth. There is no air show on Sunday.
Here is what we have in store for you in this month's Roundabout. There is the Jennifer Meets interview with Mary MacDonald, followed by her choice of music.
Camilla will be reading out 10 quiz questions, the answers to which will be read out later in the programme.
Babs Astley will be reading her story entitled Miracles Do Happen.
Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald will be discussing the book All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot.
Aileen will be sharing her Letter from a Dog Walker.
And Fran Frank will be talking about some unusual pools around Devon.
Valerie Forrester will be reading a message from the Guide Dogs Association regarding free training for anyone who wants to feel confident when guiding a friend or relative with sight loss.
We will have part two of John Townsend's conversation with Geoffrey Wilde, followed by Geoffrey's choice of music to conclude the programme.
We start off with Jenny Jenkins and her guest, Mary MacDonald.
Hello, dear listener. Today we have another of the voices that you will know from our Roundabout programme. Hello and welcome to Jennifer Meets, our book reviewer, well, one of our book reviewers, Mary MacDonald.
Good morning, listener.
To begin with, Mary, can you tell us where and when you were born?
I was born in 1943, in December, in Bilsley, which is one of the suburbs of South Birmingham.
And did you have any siblings?
I had, at that time when I was born, I had an 11-year-old brother And then 11 years later, I acquired an 11 year... when I was 11, I beg your pardon, I acquired another brother.
Oh,
so well, my brothers are 22 years apart.
Well spread out. What did your father and mother do when they were living there?
My mother was a grammar school girl. And in those days, even at grammar school, you left school at 15. And she went to work at Folks Furriers, which in a sense is still going, actually. She married my father when she was 16. My father was coming up to 20, very young, even in those days. And she continued to work, which wasn't very good. At the, people, ladies who worked really weren't allowed.
What were their names?
Oh, this was Edith Mary.
Yes.
And my father's splendid name was Royal Ward, R-O-Y-L-E-W-A-R-D.
Where did that
Fantastic
come from?
Well, I don't really know. I don't know, unless there was some connection to his mother, Lizzie. Lizzie Windridge was a nurse, lifelong, even though she had, I know, seven children. Mm. There's quite a bit something to do with that. Who knows?
Well, I believe he had an injury which
he
dominated his life.
He joined the RAF at the start of the war and was a dispatch rider and was involved in an accident with the motorbike, which crushed his lower leg and ankle. It was a very, very bad injury. He suffered with it for the rest of his life, really, because it had ongoing effects, heart and so on, and strain. But he was marvellous. He had lots of operations. Bits of bone were still coming out 15 years later. But there was a point where they were going to take the whole thing off for their peace of mind. But he went against that. So he was calipered for a long time, struck up a friendship with a local cobbler, and between them they designed a shoe. Raised shoe, and he never wore a caliper again.
What a clever man.
Wonderful.
Clever.
Yeah. Well, that's his, so his engineering. It was in him, you see, looking and designing, working things out.
Amazing. Well, he was coming up to 20 and your mother was 16 when you married.
Yes.
So
that
was
an
early start. Getting back to you now, what was your favourite subject at school? Did you enjoy school?
I enjoyed primary, but partly as well because I went to nursery before that, because my parents endured this on the way. And so I went into primary school and absolutely loved it. The first day, my mother forgot to fetch me, and I walked home with two boys who lived locally. I was four, and that was it. So I had a super time, really, at primary school.
And then you managed to get into grammar school?
Yes.
And what were your favourite subjects then?
History, geography, English, of course. Art. I can't say I enjoyed my secondary school, to be honest.
Oh, well,
brand new modern school, and I think everybody was learning, they're feeling their way.
Well, let's move out of there and get on to what you always wanted to do when you left school, if there was such a thing.
I was determined to be a driver in the Wrens. I don't know why. There's no reason for it. Unless it's the link to my older brother who had done national service in the Royal Navy. But that's the only reason I can think of it.
But you didn't. You turned into a telephonist, I believe.
Well, I guess I joined what was the GPO in those days, at 16. And I did like that. I really enjoyed that. Unfortunately, I incurred an injury pushing plugs in with my thumb, wire injury, which went very bad ways and ended up with me becoming allergic to penicillin and eventually having my tonsils out. Completely changed everything, and they were very good, and of course there was no rules in those days about sacking people, so I changed jobs and went to work in an office, got married from while I was there, and then changed jobs again and became pregnant finally.
you'd bought a house by then, and how long were you married then?
I was in that marriage till I divorced him for 13 years.
But
it was a desperately unhappy marriage.
All right. Okay.
But I did have two lovely sons, so that was the compensation.
But you decided to upgrade your education. How did you do that?
Yes. Well, I needed to go and get a lot of GCSEs because by that time I thought about going into teaching. So I went to college, and which was, again, as a mature student in those days, it was quite exciting because those sort of late teenage, early 20 years of things that were changing at the time didn't happen to me till I was 28.
But you then, you did separate and you got a job with Britannic
I got a job insurance. Eventually at Britannic Assurance, mm-hmm. again with loads and loads of young people. Brilliant. Again, a different missed out experience in my younger years. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed that. But by that time, we had completely separated. I was living with other young women, teachers actually again, in Harborne in Birmingham, mm-hmm. and just progressed from there, really.
You're a survivor, aren't you?
Got to be, haven't you?
Well, by then, you met your partner.
I did, yes. And again, coincidences, mutual friends, and it's always the best way because at least you know you're mixing with people you're already familiar with. But yes, it really was, in his case particularly, love at first sight. I was just very thankful for someone who treated me normally. But it was lovely. We really got on. Aww. I wouldn't get married because been there, done that. Sorry about that.
Yes.
We settled down. We got rented a house.
And
eventually,
you had a baby. You had your baby.
We had our baby.
Yes.
And a constant joke is for some years afterwards, our little son would say, "Mummy, do you remember when we got married?"
Lovely.
It could be quite difficult at
times. Oh, dear.
But yes, it was a very good marriage. Our son was very happy. All the boys by then were reunited.
Mm-hmm.
Life then became, as one expects one happy life to be.
And then you were for 17 years at a Birmingham school, is it? SNA?
Oh, yes. It's special needs.
Okay.
It had all different names in those days.
But then the worst thing happened.
Yes, the worst thing happened. Yes, my beloved husband died suddenly, very suddenly, mm-hmm. massive heart attack. Our son was actually away for the first time ever in climbing mountains in Scotland.
Oh, dear.
That was a terrible time. But at those times, you know that your friends are there for you.
But your family were reunited. You had your three boys.
Yes, the boys all together, we all got back together. Some a long
wonderful.
Time before that. Yes.
But then, tell me what happened when you were 60.
Oh,
when the word Dawlish comes to mind.
Sometime before that, my youngest son by then had married a Dawlish girl, and it was, let's go, move down. No, I can't move down. So eventually, I said that I would and sold my house and came. And I asked my mother to come. She wouldn't, refused for ages. But then her health deteriorated and I had to fetch her down. So she actually lived here for some time. She lived here till she was 98.
Oh, well done. But you moved here and you joined the Towns Women's Guild and on a committee. You sang with the Guild of Singers, raising funds and in lots of other guild activities. And then Strand Community Trust for 5 years. It sounds as if you really fell on your feet coming this way. But tell me about your life in general then. You picked yourself up by your bootstraps.
Absolutely,
and
yes.
got involved with Dawlish.
Well, one of the things that works for some people, not for us, I went straight back to work after my husband died.
Good for you.
And being the winter, everything, like your friends, is delays of everything. Mm. But that's what kept me going.
Excellent.
It was heartbreaking, but it kept me going. But of course, when you've got children, you've got their friends coming in.
Yes.
However old they are, you've got their friends coming out.
But you have.
It coming here was a huge step for me, but it was like a new life. A whole new life,
yes.
A new section of my life. And I have loads of such close friends here, as well as my Midland friends. And loads of acquaintances.
And family, that's
and family.
Expanded. What have you got in your family?
Well, of course, yes, now what, with three boys, I have eight grandchildren, five great-grandchildren.
And?
Another one on the way.
Are they boys or girls?
I have three sons, four granddaughters and four grandsons, four great-granddaughters and one grandson. And I hear that the next one expected is to be a girl. So.
Well, I'm glad you're a good traveller with them all spread about. But back to Here and Now and Roundabout and the book reviews with Stephen Taylor.
Oh,
now,
yes.
I want to know who chooses the books that you have to read and how long does it take you to read them?
We choose each month one another. Stephen does one month and I do the next month.
Right.
that way we get a variety of reading. Sometimes we've done poetry and sometimes we've done biographies and so on. Yes. At the moment we seem to be in a fix of fiction, but very varied, of course. Mm. You're seeing it from a much younger man's viewpoints,
right.
Likes and dislikes, and mine. But it's always stimulating, and we always enjoy doing it, and we do it straight off.
That's good.
We just get together and talk about how we feel. But sometimes, you know, you pick up a mighty tome and you think, oh, really? And once you start, you can't put it down. And another time you'll pick one up and you think, oh, this looks good. And you wish you hadn't even started.
And then you have to do the review.
But you've got to do it.
Yes, and unbiased. Yes, of course. Well, sadly, our time is running out. But I do remember one that you reviewed, a very short little book called Foster, and I bought it and read it with relish, being warned by you not to read the last page.
Absolutely.
And it's now been made into a film.
It has.
So you see, I take your review seriously.
Good.
But now I have to end the program by asking you kindly if you have chosen a piece of music that you would like us to play us out with, and why you chose it.
Well, as I say, I've always loved to sing, right from an early age, and you know, choirs and so on through. And there are some wonderful voices. I'm glow with admiration for the miracle of the human voice. But this song has nothing to do with voice. Mm-hmm. His voice is very plain. It's a theme song to a movie from some years ago. The Windmills of Your Mind, Noel Harrison is singing it.
Ah, the Thomas Crown.
I think
Crown
it's written
affair.
By somewhere by Ben Gellis or somebody, Van Gellis, somebody like that.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful, evocative for me of that time when I was in further education, mm-hmm. and all those younger people, mm-hmm. the sort of people who were not acknowledged before that,
mm-hmm.
and I was privileged to meet them all and enjoy those 2 years amongst them. I just love it, and every time I hear it, it brings it back again. But it was a great film anyway.
Yes, Thomas Crown Affair. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. And I think we've come to the end of our time, except to say a huge thank you to you, Mary, for finding time to come and chat with me.
Thank you.
And share with our listener. But all we have to say now is to our listener, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, listener.
And thank you once again.
A circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on a never spinning reel, like a snowball down a mountain or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Like a tunnel that you follow to a tunnel of its own, down a hollow to a cavern where the sun has never shone. Like a door that keeps revolving in a half-forgotten dream, or the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream. Like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space. Like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walk along the shore and leave their footprints in the sand. Is the sound of distant drumming just the fingers of your hand? Pictures hanging in a hallway and the fragment of a song. Half-remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, you were suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the colour of her hair. A circle in a spiral, a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on an ever-spinning reel, as the images unwind like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
That song was The Windmills of Your Mind, sung by Noel Harrison.
Here are 10 quiz questions for you. The first 5 are on the subject of acronyms. Can you give the full definition of the following acronyms? 1. NASA. 2. SCUBA. 3. LASER. 4. ISA. 5. ASBO. 5 questions are on the subject of British city nicknames. 6. Which British city has the nickname London by the Sea? 7. Which British city has the nickname City of Perspiring Dreams? 8. Which British city has the nickname City of 1,000 Trades and also the Pen Shop of the World? 9. Which British city has the nickname Granite City? And 10. Which British city has the nickname The City of 6 Towns? The answers will be given later on in the programme.
We now have Babs Astley with a story she has written entitled Miracles Do Happen.
Miracles do happen. Chloe yawned and stretched and looked out of the window. It was a lovely sunny day and she was looking forward to spending it relaxing and was planning on taking a walk to the beach later. She was one of the local vets and was also a member of the Sea Wildlife Rescue Service. She shared a house with Sally, one of the veterinary nurses, and Liz, who worked at the local pharmacy. When the girls had rare time off together, they liked to go out in Chloe's little boat. Its outboard motor meant they could go along the coast looking at the wildlife, lots of seabirds and seals. And there were porpoises and dolphins further out to sea, although they often came in close to the bays along the coast. There were small beaches jotted along where the girls liked to settle for the day and often had them to themselves as some of them were only accessible by boat. On this particular day, however, the other two were working, so Chloe put on her swimming costume under her shorts and t-shirt and put some undies, her latest book to read, and a large bottle of water into her small rucksack and set off for the short walk to the beach. As she got nearer, she noticed a group of people on the beach, crowding around something on the sand. And it wasn't until she got nearer that she realised it was a dolphin, which had obviously got too close and been washed up by a large wave. And as the tide was going out, it had got itself beached. She immediately phoned the number for the Sea Wildlife Rescue Service and ran as quickly as she could onto the beach. As she approached the crowd around the dolphin, she calmly told everyone to move back. And as there were quite a few children with buckets and spades, she calmly asked them all to collect as much seawater as they could in their buckets and bring it to her. She also asked the adults to soak towels in seawater and bring them to her so that she could keep it moist by putting it over it. Also, she noticed clumps of seaweed further down the beach and asked some of the children to bring that to her. By this time she had squatted on the sand near the dolphin and asked one of the fathers to keep people back so as not to frighten the poor creature any more. She gently examined the dolphin and was reassured that it hadn't been there too long and was unharmed, but badly in need of moisture, and it was important to get it back into the water as soon as possible. She hoped her colleagues from the rescue service wouldn't be too long getting there with the appropriate rescue equipment. She spoke soothingly to the dolphin and noticed that it had a couple of nicks on its dorsal fin and a mark above its left eye. But as these were obviously old injuries, she wasn't concerned about them at all. Very soon the buckets of water started arriving, and she poured it over the dolphin, and the children then rushed off to get more. One of the fathers appeared with a large bin full of water, and other people arrived with soaked towels. "I noticed the beach cafe had these bins outside," he said, "so when I explained the situation, they gave me one of their spare ones, so hopefully it will provide more seawater than the children's buckets." "That's great," said Chloe. "I can use it to soak the towels in, but I'd still like the children to keep bringing their bucketfuls, as every little helps, and it will keep them involved without getting too close to the dolphin. They've also brought me some seaweed." Fortunately, the rescue service arrived quickly, and because Chloe had been able to ascertain that the dolphin was unharmed, they, with their special canvas carrier, were able to carry it back into the water, and a big cheer went up as they watched it swim off the carrier and out to find its pod. A few weeks later, the three girls had time off together and decided to take the boat out. They spent some time quite close to the shore looking at the birds and seals near the land, and then they decided to go further out to see if there was any sign of dolphin pods. The sea had been very calm when they set off, but it started to get more choppy, and after getting a few miles offshore, Chloe decided they ought to think about returning. Just as they were starting to head for the shore, there was a splutter and the engine died. "Oh, heck," said Chloe, "that's all we need." And she jumped overboard to have a look to see what the problem was. She'd only been in the water a few minutes when a large wave came and washed her into the side of the boat, where she hit her head, and it was obvious to the other two that she was unconscious. Sally immediately got out her phone and telephoned the Coast Guard, and Liz leaned over to try and get Chloe nearer to the boat, but the waves by now were too strong and they just took Chloe further away from the boat. Liz wanted to jump in to help, but Sally held her back. "It's no point you getting into trouble as well. We'll just have to try and paddle the boat closer and hope her life jacket will keep her up." However, it soon became obvious that Chloe was being dragged further away from the boat. The other two girls were beginning to get very distressed when there was a whoosh and a grey streak had arrived and lifted Chloe up out of the water. It was a dolphin, and it had manoeuvred itself under Chloe and was keeping her afloat and slowly advancing towards the boat. In the distance, the girls could see the Coast Guard boat fast approaching, and in no time it arrived alongside their boat, and the rescue crew were able to first lift Chloe gently off the dolphin's back and into the rescue boat, and then help the other two girls into the boat. With a flip of its tail, the dolphin spun up into the air and headed back out to sea to the rest of its pod. Chloe came round when they were all safely in the rescue boat, and the other two excited girls couldn't wait to tell her about the dolphin's rescue of her. "Oh, that's amazing," she said. "Did you notice anything about it? Any markings or such like?" "Well, actually," said Sally, "I did notice that it had a mark above its left eye and a couple of nicks on its dorsal fin." Chloe immediately realised that it had been the dolphin that she had rescued weeks earlier, and with tears running down her face, she explained to the girls and the crew what had happened. "Well," said Liz, "I think we can say that miracles really do happen."
Hello. This month, Mary and I have been reading one of my absolute favourite books, one I've read several times in my life, and I thought it was about time we did one that I can talk about with real enthusiasm, which is All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot, which has been dramatized. There are films, there are two television series, I think probably radio series. It's very, very well known, but there is nothing like the original books. They are splendid.
And lent themselves very much to having a television series, because I hadn't realised, and of course common sense should have told me, that each is a separate little story, a tiny little part of a day in his life. So when it was visualised onto television, you could see the brilliance of the person who'd screenwritten it and put it all together. But all those little stories, hearing them like this, you miss the horrible sight of all the poo and the blood and all the awful things, and you just get the description of it, which you can deal with. But I did love it, and all those lovely personal remarks about the people in it and the creatures he comes across, both the domestic and the farm animals. It was lovely. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's really got everything, this book, because it's very funny. It's moving, and it's fantastically moving at times, especially if you're an animal lover. And there's a lovely love story that runs through it. And what you don't get with the dramatization so much is the description of the science and what it was like to be a vet in the 1930s and the limited equipment they had. And he's writing about that, and he's explaining it. And it's not heavy science by any means, but you do learn a lot about the way that animal bodies work, and foals are born and calves are born, and the various illnesses that they get. And you begin to understand why they have to be called out in the middle of the night.
And the fact that they had really awful equipment and medicines to deal with the issues that are commonplace now. And as you're going through the book, that crops up in the natural flow of the conversation of it, in that, of course, these days we've got this to deal with and that to deal with, but a bottle of some magic mixture seemed to satisfy many farmers, because they swore by it. That wasn't anything else. But when you look at the equipment, and he himself looking at even older equipment, even older than what they were working with in the 30s, it was immaculate, stored from the previous vet, beautifully pristine. And in fact, Tristan used it at one point, I think, in one of the dealings with one of the animals. It's great.
Yeah. And it's full of great characters. So you've got the central characters, who are James Herriot himself. He's a young, straight out of veterinary college, arrives in Yorkshire from Scotland, and just completely takes to the place, falls for it. You know, it's a wonderful love story about Yorkshire as much as anything. And then these two very eccentric brothers who he works alongside, the Farnans, who they're just hysterically funny, the different characters and the way they spark off each other. And all the farmers, and this woman with the dog called Tricky Woo.
Oh, gosh, yes. How lovely is she? Are they?
It's gentle, but it's just pure pleasure reading this book.
And it's honest. It's so honest what you're reading or listening to, or even if you get the chance to see it or have seen it in the past. It's so truthful, so honest, and as you say, a love affair with the countryside, which the modern vets now still adore. They still love standing in a private place and looking out at the aspects of summer and winter, and the seasons flow, and everything is guided by the seasons. And the awful cars they're forced to drive, the days before driving tests, days before MOTs, great.
A lot of drinking going on as well.
Yes, and a lot of drinking.
And that's fun. And there are some really good jokes in there. And, of course, this is the first of six, I think, books that he wrote. I mean, they were terrifically successful. He took forever to get a publisher. How on earth anyone could have turned this down when they first read it? But he did. It took him years to find someone to publish it. And then, you know, quite late in life, well, he was still practicing as a vet, he made a huge amount of money and became super famous. And so his own story is remarkable.
Yes, it is. And it's well worth covering. Well worth covering.
The title of the book that Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald have reviewed is All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook. Let's find out what Aileen and Honey Bear have been up to in their latest walk.
Dear listener, I'm sitting rather uncomfortably, sharing a chair with Honey, writing this letter to you from our balcony, overlooking a glassy, breathless sea. On the table there's a recently pruned pot of basil, and it is my hope that I will gain inspiration from its peppery, lemony, green smell. The last few days have been very warm, and Honey Bear and I have taken to walking in the late afternoon when the heat has tempered a little. She is entirely happy with this arrangement, but she seeks me out every now and then to make sure I haven't forgotten. Eventually I'm forced to react. You're invited to join us in Muir's Park. The park comprises four separate but adjoining areas. First, fronting Rowden's house are specimen trees, lawn and shrubbery. Next, a walled garden, which is still undergoing remedial work. And the third, known as the Dell, is an exotic water garden bordering several descending ponds. Finally, the largest area is the meadows. The majority of the park was gifted to the people of Tynmouth by the Mules family, who were former owners of Cliveden House, which is now the Cliveden Hotel. Honey Bear and I leave the car at the entrance nearest Rowden's house, which is, in its present existence, divided up into several apartments. Every summer, one of the residents plants enormous ornamental tubs and hanging baskets, but this year they have not yet appeared. Perhaps they will be there next time we pass. The residents of the house have an idyllic view out to sea, and as Honey is off in hot but vain pursuit of a squirrel, I stop to enjoy the view. The stillness is broken by the thumping noise of an unseen speedboat bouncing over the incoming waves. But this noise soon fades and tranquility returns. In a shady spot beyond a massive fir tree, a group of teenagers sit on a log and on the surrounding dry grass, talking, laughing and romancing. The Dog Dip, just beyond this group, is the destination now singled out by Honey, who, like most canine visitors to the park, knows its location and the joy of its cool water to drink and to lie in. Sometimes there is a boisterous queue, but today we are lucky, and Honey Bear wallows alone like a happy hippo. My wet friend shares the cooling water by shaking the excess all over me. Today I don't mind. We enter the meadows and turn left up the steep incline, passing between thick shrubs on the left and meadow on the right. The early springtime mowing cut a border all around the edge, leaving everything else uncut, with tall wild flowers and grasses now permitted to set seed for next year. At the apex of the meadow, two tall poplar trees, clothed in their full summer finery, are impressive. In one of my letters to you several years ago, I wrote about the severe and wanton damage inflicted on the bark of the taller, a Lombardy poplar. At the time, the council's parks department took advice from a tree expert, and survival was dependent upon the bark regrowing naturally, which was, they thought, unlikely. Miraculously, the bark has regrown, and the tree stands tall and clothed in leaves for another summer. Fingers crossed, it will be there for many more years to come, because, like the rest of the trees in the park, they are precious and belong to everyone in Tynmouth, or everyone who visits the park. On the lighter note, you may recall me writing about honey running through buttercups. Well, the buttercups have faded and been replaced by a field of clover. The bees love clover and hum happily as they descend to gather the nectar. As a child, I remember my father giving me a segment of clover to suck and finding it distinctively sweet. There isn't much nectar, however, in one flower, so just think how many hummingbees and how many flowers are required to make a single pot of clover honey. We continue towards the sea in the company of a cocker spaniel named Billy and his mongrel terrier housemate Bobby, both known and liked by honey. Their walker is good company, and I am sad when we part, and she carries on towards Tynmouth seafront. Honey and I turn back along the lower path, passing through a tunnel of beech, cherry, heavy with swelling buds of fruit, young oak, pungent elder, hawthorn, and many more species through which the sun shines. The path looks like a painter has flicked a yellow paint-filled brush randomly along its length, and honey takes on the changing colours as she runs through the dappled light. Little hoverflies become visible as they dance together in the sunny patches. In the leaf litter under an enormous oak, a wren searches for grubs and is undisturbed by honey and me, sensing we are friends. With honey on her lead, we descend to the coolness of the dell. Water trickles between the ponds, encouraging a green carpet of pondweed on the middle pond and maintaining the arum lilies and the gunera, known as Chilean rhubarb, which grows leaves of in excess of 6 feet wide. The friends of Heathcliff have been busy preparing the grounds and planting seasonal shrubs on one of the banks, and I recognise acanthus and a fuchsia. It is time to depart by completing the circle up through the lawn in front of Rowden's house. Honey has dried completely, so we keep away from the dog dip because I don't want a wet dog in the car. Home to a cold drink for both of us. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
Here are the answers to the quiz questions. 1. The full definition of NASA is National Aeronautics and Space Administration. 2. The full definition of scuba is self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. 3. The full definition of laser is light amplification by stimulated
emission of radiation. 4. The full definition of ISA is individual savings account. 5. The full definition of ASBO is an antisocial behaviour order. 6. Which city's nickname is London by the Sea? Answer, Brighton. 7. Which city's nickname is the City of Perspiring Dreams? Answer, Cambridge. 8. Which city's nickname is City of a Thousand Trades and also the Pen Shop of the World? Answer, Birmingham. 9. Which city's nickname is Granite City? Answer, Aberdeen. 10. Which city's nickname is the City of Six Towns? Answer, Stoke-on-Trent. You can also put down Stoke, that'll be fine. Congratulations if you got all the answers right.
Here is Fran Frank to talk about some unusual pools around Devon.
Hello. In a previous recording, I talked about some of the more unusual railway lines in the county. Well, today I'm going to mention a couple of unusual swimming pools. And I don't mean leisure centres. I'm referring to seawater pools. We are, of course, an island nation and have used and benefited from the sea for centuries. But the idea of swimming or bathing in the sea was promoted by the Victorians, who considered it good for their health. They would flock to their nearest seaside, either by charabanc or by the newly built railway lines, and bathe directly in the sea. If you were a lady and wanted some privacy, you might also have used one of the discreet changing rooms, which were designed like a beach hut on wheels, and with the assistance of a horse, would be moved down the beach to the water's edge, so that you could use the steps and gently lower yourself into the shallows. Although the Victorians liked the idea of bathing in the sea, very few of them actually learned how to swim. So dunking themselves, rather than swimming, was the norm. Mind you, I'm sure that the local children would already have learnt to swim, even if their parents didn't realise it. Early seawater pools were created more by nature than by design. People would find areas along the coast where they could access the water either directly from the beach or from rocky headlands, but only when the tide was right and only when the sea was calm. Remember, they couldn't all swim. Eventually, someone realised that the benefits of bathing in seawater should not rely on the state of the tide, and decided to create swimming pools where the water could be retained and made available at all times of the day. Devon still has 11 of these seawater pools in current use, but I am only going to mention a couple of them. One in North Devon and one in South Devon. One of the earliest seawater pools to be created in the county was built in 1820 by the Ilfracombe Sea Bathing Company and is referred to as the Tunnels. Over 100 Welsh miners were employed by the company to carve out 6 access tunnels through the headland, providing access for horse-drawn carriages as well as people on foot. The beach on the far side of the headland was quite sheltered, and there were a number of rocky areas where nature created its own seawater pools. At the time, these areas were segregated into male and female, for modesty purposes, of course. But once the bathing company had access to the beach, they went on to develop an area and erected a bathhouse providing hot and cold health treatments. Although the locals in North Devon have always known about the tunnels and the beach, it only came back into regular use a few years ago, when someone decided to develop it into a visitor attraction. Apparently, the outlines of the original pools have suffered over the years from storm damage, and as a result of this, the retaining walls can only be seen at certain times either side of low tide. Moving across the county, the Tyneside Lido at Plymouth is an Art Deco style pool built in 1935 by the Plymouth Borough Council. The stonework around the Lido is painted in brilliant white, with stripes in two shades of blue painted across the floor of the pool itself. Whether this is to help people who want to swim lengths, I'm not sure, but it certainly adds to the visual attraction of the Lido, especially when the sun is shining. The pool, which is built at sea level of course, is semi-circular in shape with a diameter of 180 feet. The entrance building provides changing rooms as well as areas for sunbathing and looks out over the pool towards Drake's Island and Plymouth Sound. The pool was actually closed in 1992 and renovated at a cost of £3.4 million before being reopened in 2003. Well, I hope you've enjoyed hearing about the tunnels and Tyneside Lido. If you are ever in Ilfracombe or near Plymouth Hoe, either of these would be worth investigating. I know that a number of my family and friends are keen on wild water swimming. I wonder if they realise that the Victorians were way ahead of them on this idea. Bye!
Well, Aileen, has the current warm weather tempted you to try out any of Devon's seawater pools?
No fear, I'm staying on dry land. Valerie Forrester has a message from the Guide Dogs Association, which may be of interest to your friends and relatives.
Hello, this is Valerie, and I'm just going to read an article that came from Guide Dogs. Guide Dogs offers free training for anyone who wants to feel confident when guiding a friend or family member aged 18 and over with a vision impairment. The training will enable participants to help their friend or family member get out and about and do the things they enjoy, from garden centres to gigs. This is a virtual group session where participants will learn or refresh the skills to guide safely with expert support from our staff, and participants can meet people in a similar situation for mutual support. In this two-hour session, friends and family of those with sight loss will learn how to help your friend or family member get around the obstacles they come across every day so that they can get out and about with confidence, get top tips for practical guiding such as the correct grip to use, walking through narrow spaces and how to detect changes on the ground and at head level. Discuss some of the emotional consequences of sight loss. Get an introduction to issues around access rights for those with sight loss. Meet others with similar experiences with a chance to share knowledge and helpful tips with each other. If you'd like to take part in this, you can contact Guide Dogs. Their telephone number is 0800 781 1444. I'll repeat that. 0800 781 1444. Or you can visit their website. It's the Friends and Family section of the following webpage, www.guidedogs.org.uk/sightedguiding. I hope some of you will find this useful. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm John Townsend, and I'm pleased to say I'm back with Devon Dialogues, my series of talks with professional performers from the arts. This is my second chat with Geoffrey Wilde, our Dawlish star of screen and stage. Welcome back, Geoffrey. It's great to talk to you again.
It's nice to be back.
Well,
thank you.
Brilliant. And I left listeners last time guessing about one or two of the famous actors you worked with. Now, can I take you right back to, I think it was 1947, when you had just finished your drama school training, and you got the part of playing an understudy. Now, tell us who it was and where.
Well, there were 200 of us young actors at the Hippodrome auditioning for an understudy. And two of us ended up at the end. I was taken in by the director, the other boy was taken in by the co-director, and we were both ash blondes, funnily enough, and we were asked if we'd have our hair dyed. And I said yes, the other man said no, so he was kicked out, and I got the role of understudy to the late Dirk Bogarde.
Wow.
He was a thorough gentleman. In fact, he asked his dresser to come up to me after about a month in the play Power and the Glory by Graham Greene at the Hippodrome Theatre, and asked his dresser to come up to ask me to come down with my diary. And I thought, whatever's going on? So I went down to his star dressing room, stage level, and he told his dresser to clear off, in other words, but he didn't use clear.
Yeah, all right.
And shut the door. And he gave me 5 dates when he was going to ring up and say he was poorly, and I'd give me the chance to go on. And he was a thorough gentleman. I can thank him for that.
Yeah. So,
well, and I was still at drama school. I was, you know.
Right. So if you want to get on in life, have your hair dyed. That's the thing. Yeah.
So, and I had my hair dyed.
And you played at the Hippodrome in London, presumably to big audiences.
Yeah.
And on those days that he had arranged to do other things.
Yeah.
And it went well, did it?
You it had went very well. Yeah. And the other star actor was Kenneth Moore.
Ah, the famous Kenneth Moore.
Yeah.
And was he, you got on all right with him?
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we're into the name-dropping game, Geoffrey. I think we've got to mention a few more. Now, I have in front of me a card written to you. You played the part, I believe, of somebody called Saville.
Yes.
In a play. What was the play?
I can't remember.
Oh,
it
right,
was
okay.
By George Bernard Shaw.
Oh, okay.
But they liked me so much, and, you know, I was taken in by then and taken to dinner.
Yeah.
And they called me Saville ever after.
Ah, well, I have a card here. The beautiful Vivian Lee and Sir Laurence Olivier, when they were a couple, and it says on the back, our dear love to you, darling Saville, for Christmas. We have not seen you for ages. And it goes on, and then it says, with love from Laurie and Vivian.
And I'm just, this was presumably written by Vivian herself, I would imagine. Yes. And I think you told me earlier, she did actually live locally.
Yes. What people don't know or don't remember, she married a man called Lee Holman, and they lived in Tynmouth, and just past New Road and top of the hill. And she had a daughter called Susan Holman to the first husband. And then she went off to do a film where she met Laurence Olivier. And they fell in love, and she divorced Lee and went to live at the old barn and abbey.
Yeah. So you knew her then after she'd been in Gone with the Wind?
Yes.
Because you were only a lad then, weren't you?
Oh, I was. 1939. Yeah.
So let's move things on. Thank you for telling us about that. And I'm sure you've worked, well, you were telling me earlier, all sorts of actors.
Well, the other lovely actress I worked with was the late Thora Heard in a show called Love Match.
Yes.
And Arthur Askey was the star with her.
Yeah.
And she got me my first screen test.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. While I was in it, I went to London and came back and did the evening performance.
Wow.
She arranged it all. And it was all because of my daughter, Janet Scott.
Uh-huh.
But I got the part, but my grandfather didn't put the same amount of money as a billionaire put in. And his son got the part in the end.
Oh, right.
But so I never played it.
Yeah,
and it was in a film called Free Love,
right?
About a couple that eloped to Gretna Green.
You mentioned your grandfather and how he said you need another string to your bow. You need to do some kind of training and a career. And I think you did then go on. I might be jumping a long way ahead here, but what brought you to Dawlish and what did you do when you came here?
I came to, my grandfather used to rent a house sometimes on Marine Parade for his five daughters, my grandmother, and the nanny for me.
Yes.
And that's how I came to Dawlish first.
Okay, so that was
That was my Albertini days.
Oh, I see, way back
when I had a break off.
Yeah.
In 35, 36.
Yeah. But didn't you then...
And then, later, I was staying with my uncle while we were writing the play
at
Alcibiades. And in the Express and Echo, the local paper, there was an advert. They wanted students at the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital. I thought, I had a break. And so I thought, I'll do nursing. And then honour my grandfather, what I promised him, and do a proper job. So I trained there for 3 years and did 6 months as a staff nurse. Then I got another... You know, went into acting again when
So you're able to dip in and out, and
Well, I still kept my agent.
Yeah,
and
I see.
He kept me.
Yes. So I suppose acting is quite a precarious career
because
there are periods of resting, shall we say?
Yeah.
And was your agent based down here?
I had an agent based down here, and he had an office in London and Bristol.
Okay, so got you quite a bit of work, but then you developed this nursing career as well.
Yeah. And then I came to Dawlish later on because I thought, I'm going to honour my grandfather's, what I promised him, and go and do mental health and psychology. And Ivycroft was in Eastcliff Road in Dawlish. And I heard a girl who was already training there. And she said, you ought to train if you want to do this. I said, well, it's another string and another trick, under my sleeve.
Yeah.
And that was Ivycroft in Eastcliff Road.
I see. Oh. So I know you've been involved in a lot of local theatre.
Yeah, I try and do local things.
Yeah, I know. Well, we've been in a play together, haven't we?
We have.
And you've done plenty of pantomimes and serious drama, and I think every genre. You used to dance, I think, didn't you?
I did.
Dancing.
I did a song and dance contract for a time, and I was booked to do P&O Liners.
Oh, brilliant.
The Orsova I was on, but I was so seasick, I had to get leave after 6 months.
Ah, oh, what a shame. I mean, you brought in this wonderful album of photographs, and going through it, seeing you in some very dashing roles, I have to say.
I love doing musicals, but the best play I did, as I you know, was Month of Sundays.
Yeah, so you were playing an older person with
Alzheimer's.
But it's would you call it a dark comedy? What? How would you describe it?
Oh, it was a great comedy.
Oh, a good.
It was very funny.
Yeah, okay.
About two old men in a nursing home who were trying to escape.
Oh, I see. Right.
And they kept raising their wine glasses over a game of chess and saying to the escape committee.
Where did you play this? Which theatre?
I played it all round.
All round. You do, yeah. Oh, yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. I think you have bringing it more up to date. You've done films as well and television.
Yes, I did.
Any particular television you want to
I'd love to mention Tess of the D'Urbervilles, which I filmed in Gloucester with the girl called Gemma Atterton, who was a Bond girl.
Oh, right.
And it's coming up shortly. She's done such many things. Yeah. Very talented girl.
Yeah.
And I loved her.
Yeah.
And every time she had to cry, there were real tears. She
really?
Didn't have to call on the makeup people to come and do the glycerine.
How long ago do you think you did that one? Was it?
It must have been in the 90s.
Yeah, okay. And I know you did a film with Miranda Hart.
Oh, yes. I did a film that was originally called Friends Disunited.
Mm-hmm.
And Miranda Hart wasn't famous then. She wasn't popular. She hadn't done Call the Midwife and all the comedy roles.
Yes.
And she suddenly got famous. So in 2009, because we filmed in 2007, they made it in colour with her as the star.
Yeah. So, and you were, I think you played...
I played the butler. It was about, like an Agatha Christie, it was a school reunion.
Yeah. Oh, and you enjoyed that.
House.
You had good
fun. I enjoyed it very much.
I'm sure we can get the
DVD. And it's on DVD.
DVD, should anybody wish to see you, there you are.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you, Jeff, we're sort of coming to an end now. I know you're still involved in your, particularly at the Shaftesbury Theatre in Dawlish, and we've been in things there. And you're
and in Torquay and Paignton.
Yeah, so you're still a local performer, and I know you've directed and done all kinds of things. But I'm going to ask you if you'd like to choose a piece of music to finish with. I don't know if you've had chance to think about this. As a parting shot to us, if you
What about There's No Business Like Show Business?
Well, I'm sure we can find a suitable version of that, and we can all sing along with it, not on the recording, but at home.
Well, I'm sure the people, your listeners, will love it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing. I know that we could have gone on all day because you've got all these wonderful photographs and memories of productions, but thank you for telling us all about your full life.
Well, I'd like to thank you for asking me. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Brilliant.
And I hope your readers will too.
Thank you.
Or listeners.
So, goodbye from us for now.
Goodbye.
Like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. You open, and there you are. Next day on your dressing room, they've hung a star. Let's go on with the show. The costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come. There's no business like show business, like no business I know. You get word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. And top of that, your partner might have parted, you're brokenhearted, but you go on. There's no people like no people. They smile when they are low. Even with a turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold. Let's go on with the show. Let's go.
That was There's No Business Like Show Business, sung by Essel Merman from the 1946 stage musical Annie Get Your Gun.
Our thanks go to Jenny Jenkins, Mary MacDonald, Babs Astley, Stephen Taylor, Aileen Clarkson, Fran Frank, Valerie Forrester, John Townsend, and his guest Jeffrey Wildy.
Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Mike Smith.